Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 26. I'm an admin, not a housekeeper. Here we go. Today our guests are Doug Carson and Phil Janke. How you doing, Phil?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. How about you, gentlemen?
I'm good. Thank you. Doug, yourself?
I'm fine, thanks.
So Phil and I kind of go way back, and if you're on Twitter, you've probably dealt with this mysterious keyboard-looking avatar replying to your tweets and eventually saying, hey, how about a follow? Phil, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I've been in IT for about 14 years, been interested in computers for much longer, obviously. By trade, I'm a systems and storage administrator. I've also worked in networking and backup systems.
Oh, cool. And if you don't know, he's on Twitter, at Rootworm, R-O-O-T-W-Y-R-M, and he writes the, I have to look it up, the Arrow 404, it's a blog at rootworm.us.to, straight out of Tonga. I love it. All right. So today our topic is I'm an admin, not a housekeeper. And, you know, the thought behind that is, you know, every environment now, especially, you know, virtualization has done this, but, you know, a lot of things are using the same environment. I don't want to go so far as to say coexistence or multi-tenancy, but, you know, we've got server teams, we've got application teams, we've got virtualization teams, we've got storage teams, all kind of piled into the same environment now. And there's a lot of things in an ongoing housekeeping mode that we all look out for. So the object of today's podcast is a little bit different. We're going to just kind of throw out some ideas and talk about them, about how these are good, valuable points to housekeep my environment. So I'll go ahead and throw out the first one. And it's templates, you know, virtual machine templates. One good takeaway is to make sure all the ones that are out there are the ones you need, and all the ones that are out there are up to date. So those are two good things with templates that I can throw out. Anybody got another good housekeeping topic you want to throw out?
I'd add a little bit to your templates, and in terms of disk alignment on the templates as well is key to having a more efficient VM on the storage. So that's one thing as well, just to, when you're creating your templates, creating your gold images, make sure all your VMs are aligned and within the guest itself.
Absolutely. And the little beep means that it's good and important just for everybody's information.
I'd expand on that a bit. Test your backups and restores to make sure that those are all working as intended, as opposed to oops.
Oh, yeah. Cheap plug for Veeam, since you said it, Phil. Testing your backups and restores, Veeam's got an answer for that. End of cheap plug. But since that's a good one, I'll give it a beep also. So, you know, in regards to templates and alignment, that's, you know, that's one of the most frequently misconfigured items in the virtualization space, because basically, you know, especially on a VMFS volume, the disk I/O goes to, you know, the primary blocks in a VMFS data store of 1, 2, 4, or 8 meg, and then traverses across 64K subblocks. So correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, but that's why everybody wants those partitions aligned at 64K. Is that right?
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Yep. And so, you know, I guess we can talk about it, but, you know, VMware Converter 5 is coming out, and it's going to have a pretty cool option on P2V. And what is that?
Yep. From what I've heard, it will automatically align the VM when you P2V it, which obviously wasn't the case in the previous versions. So it's currently in beta, so it might change, but that's one of the features that it's been talked about in the Twitter sphere, if you can call it that.
And, you know, it's one of those things. Disk alignment is a funky thing, but it's one of those things that's absolutely critical to ensure that additional blocks are not read if it's not needed. Or it's kind of like, I guess, when you're writing a file, if you write a 5K file on 4K blocks, you're hitting two different blocks. So you're writing 8K, but you really only need 5K. It's an efficiency thing, I guess, yep. If you had to explain it to the layperson.
Especially in VDI and deployments and things like that, when you're maybe spinning up or linking quite a number of VMs off of that, then you want to make sure that gold template is solid.
Gotcha. Do you ever find templates that, you know, are, if you only use it like twice, is that even worth keeping? You know, the rarely used templates, should you keep them?
Personally, my thought is that you should actually have a sort of genericized template that you just use for all of those rarely used systems, so that you still have a standard that you're building from, even if you only use it for a few machines.
Gotcha. Double ding for standards. I like it. So, you know, what I'm thinking about, though, is if anybody, you know, the one or two people out there that are actually using Windows Server Core, you know, for example, and let's just face it, the templates mostly are Windows-based. Linux people do templates too, but yeah, I think the deployment and customization options are limited. So I'm not trying to shut the Linux crowd out, but you know, we're really kind of focusing on the Windows workloads for that much. But what I'm getting at is, if you have a template that you deploy and you don't use it that often, maybe you deploy it once and never use it again, it is worth doing, simply because the consistency can be enforced. And one good example of that is the disk geometry that we talked about earlier. But the other thing I get caught on is things that aren't addressed by Microsoft group policy, okay? So, you know, you click go with a Windows system and you're up and running. Group policy, which is a good thing, can help you out a lot of the way. But, you know, there's times when there's settings that aren't addressed by group policy, so that's a nod for the template to keep everything clean.
Yep.
So what about, you know, zombie VMs, orphan VMs? Those are a good thing to watch for. Abandoned or forgotten about snapshots. Oh, those are good. Both of those are good. What kind of, I mean, there's plenty of tools to identify snapshots. Veeam's got an answer, plenty of free, you know, partner answers. PowerCLI can tell us. Phil, on the storage side, you know, SAN snapshots are a big deal also. People forget about VM snapshots, but can people forget about SAN snapshots also?
Yeah, I see a lot of that. I also see a lot of folks who kind of let their snapshots go a bit out of control. Say they've got a testing phase and they want to take a snapshot every hour. Well, they forget to turn it off. And now you've been running in production for months with snapshots every hour. It's one of those little things that people often miss.
Well, in the virtual machine world, a VMDK world, that's bad stuff when you just let it go forever. I presume there's no free lunch in the SAN space.
Oh, no. Every time you take a snapshot, you're talking about a CPU cost as well as a disk cost associated with that, and it can really quickly lead to explosive growth, and you're going, well, what happened to the 2 terabytes I just added, and it's already gone.
Mm-hmm. I think also as well, the perception of snapshots on SANs and even VMs, is some people see it as a backup when it really is just maybe a copy or a point in time that you can roll back to, but it's not there as a permanent thing.
Well, I didn't mean to put an additional Veeam plug in, but the way a snapshot, you know, by itself isn't a backup, but snapshot with smarts wrapped around it in terms of a virtual machine snapshot, plus things like application quiescence, that's all good stuff. But simply going into the interface and making a snapshot, no, not so much, because you need a tool that'll, you know, remove that snapshot when it's done, because, you know, ongoing, you can't really sustain infinite numbers of snapshots. The read and write I/O goes to crap. And it sounds like that's the same case with a storage processor. But my suspicion, Phil, is that people may have a lot more virtual machine snapshots that are smaller, but a fewer number of SAN snapshots that are bigger. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, really, it actually depends on the organization and how they do things. I find that some organizations take a stance where it's either storage or it's VMware snapshots, but not both. So there's not a lot of mixing. And there's also the issue where they will have different types of snapshots on the storage side. For example, they might do differential snapshots where it only copies of changed blocks, or they might be doing full snapshots where it's actually taking a complete image and copying the whole thing.
Now, some of these sand snapshots nowadays, be honest, they're pretty fancy and pretty smart. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. There is some really neat stuff going on in the sand space with snapshots. For example, differential-style snapshots where they're only copying the changed blocks. That's really a big thing, especially when you're working with thin provisioning, because it helps you keep on your physical disk usage.
Gotcha.
Phil, what's your opinion in terms of, you're talking about sand snapshots? I dealt with an SRM project where they were asynchronously replicating these snapshots to the DR site. But one thing we did do was we put things like page files and VSwaps off onto, you know, non-replicated LUNs. What's your opinion in terms of that kind of thing for these, reducing the size of these snapshots?
Well, generally, it depends on what the VM is being used for as far as your savings with the swap files. But I mean, the biggest problem I've seen with doing snapshots on the storage is that a lot of the times the snapshots aren't integrated with the VM or the application. So when you're doing, for example, a database and asynchronously replicating it, well, yes, you have another copy of it, but because the database wasn't quiesced and there were outstanding transactions in memory, when you try to bring that database back up, you find that it won't work because it was running when the snapshot was taken.
Application quiescence, that's a big one. So, you know, inside the application, and again, I'll pick on Windows because that's what I know more about, you know, something that can do that task with, like, volume shadow, you know, to quiesce the app, in the case of SQL Server, that'll help ensure that it's consistent. So, you know, if you've approached data protection without application consistency, it might be a good idea to reevaluate that. Go ahead, Doug.
I was just about to say I think as a kind of good practice is to, again, to make sure your tools are up to date, make sure that all those elements that allow you to do these kind of things are up to date and the relevant versions.
So that would be VMware tools, virtual machine hardware.
Yep.
Definitely your storage firmware. That is a huge deal.
Yeah, you know what? And while we're at it, server BIOS and HBA controller firmware. I mean, those little details make a big difference. And not so much just to be up to date for the sake of up to date, but I think more importantly, you'll have consistency within a cluster. So if all the hosts have version X of the server BIOS, you know, you can really kind of narrow down some of your, you know, variants of configuration, because it's pretty easy to configure consistently above, you know, at the OS in the case of a hypervisor and above, and then, you know, guest virtual machines, that's a little bit easier. But ensuring that the firmwares on the, you know, the low-level components are up to date, storage processor, rev, a good example would be, you know, like VAAI support. A lot of existing kit out there that would support it might need a firmware update or storage processor software update to support it. So, you know, don't sell yourself short on that.
Just you mentioned, Rick, earlier about orphaned VMs, and there's obviously lots of tools and things like that. I knew there was, well, it depends on the way that the VM's orphaned, I guess, isn't it? You know, it can be disconnected, or it could be actually orphaned from vCenter.
Right, so out of inventory or disconnected, those are two different things. So, you know, a view into your storage to see what's going on in terms of those types of VMs would be a good idea. And then, I mean, there's, you don't want to see people, in the case of VMFS and NFS volumes, well, not so much NFS, but VMFS volumes, you don't want to see data that's not a virtual machine or a CD-ROM ISO or a template sitting on the disk. You know, this is not, just because it's big doesn't mean you should, you know, be uploading stuff into it. So use the right zones of data for the right purpose.
Yeah. Another third type of orphan VM that I've seen a lot of is the forgotten development area. A lot of shops just set up VMs for test and dev and forget about them and leave them with huge amounts of resources, 4 gigs of memory, 250 gigs of disk, just sitting there doing nothing. never clean them up.
4 gigs of memory used to be like so big back in the day. Really?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that was like, that's all I can give you. Or, you know, that's all I'm going to give you. Let me say it that way. Simply because in the 32-bit Windows Server 2003's realm, that was kind of that comfortable ceiling. And, you know, we have that removed with the 64-bit Windows now. And it's given some memory pressure as far as, you know, keeping people at bay, but it's almost like 4 gig is the new starting point. But you're right.
Yeah.
It could be 250 gig, and maybe they wanted it thick provisioned, you know?
Yeah.
So
I had you mentioned about the memory. I saw a VM in my environment with one of the development teams, and I had a 60 gig allocated for memory.
Look out! That's crazy. 60 gig.
That's huge.
And when you looked at the performance stats, it was only active at most about 15.
So we'll call that over-provisioning. Look for that. In fact, you know, number 11 on my new list of stupid defaults, or at least annoying default configurations, is when you change the memory value, it switches megabytes and gigabytes, for example. You might, if you want somebody on Twitter, I didn't get his permission, so I'm not going to say it, but everybody knows him, had noticed that a number of his VMs that were lowly provisioned were supposed to be 256 meg. They actually were 256 gig, or maybe it's 255 gig, because that number, when you change the number in the interface, it had changed the number of gigabytes or megabytes, and he was really concerned about that. So, you know, spy around that the unit of measure on a lot of things is correct.
Yep. And I think just keep it nice and slim, you know, keep it as one vCPU if you can, keep it as a small memory, and then if you have to build up, then you build up, but keep it small starting off.
Sure, sure. How about on the storage side, Phil? Is there any, like, silly misconfigurations that people frequently make that might, you know, under-provision, over-provision, or otherwise dork it from the start?
There's a whole bunch. I mean, storage remains one of the more complex, or I should say complicated, aspects of the virtualization side, especially if you're using things like IBM's fan volume controller, where you're virtualizing the storage behind it. People have a tendency to size their storage based on thick provisioning while they're using thin provisioning on VMware side.
Yep. Get your thicks and thins all boogered up. What do you recommend? Go thick and thick, thin and thin? On both ends, or what?
Well, my take is that you should consider it somewhat on a case-by-case basis. For example, you don't want to provision your Exchange server thin on either side for obvious reasons. But if you're working with a development machine for example, PeopleSoft, and it's just a development machine, you don't need to necessarily have it thin on the storage side, but you would on the VMware side. You don't want to pair VMware thin with storage thin just because you're kind of wasting resources there in terms of CPU, and you're not seeing any real benefit from it.
The biggest thing, Phil, what I found, I don't know about yourself, is I found that people will look at storage at capacity without looking at performance. So a lot of people I've dealt with in the past, a lot of clients I've dealt with, where they just say, well, we need 3, 4, 5 terabytes, and they don't actually think, well, what's the performance I need from it? Is that something to look at?
Well, that's a big one, right? Because if they just say they need 3 terabytes, I'll mash in my credit card and throw them something up on Amazon, and they'll never know the difference, right?
that actually is a huge housekeeping tip right there as far as the storage side is, especially in environments where you have multiple tiers of storage based on your performance. You want to make sure that you've got your VM sitting in the right tier. I mean, you don't want to exchange in Tier 3 and have your development workstation that gets used once a year in your Tier 1.
So I guess we can make that sound real fancy and call it a tier appropriation analysis.
Yes.
All right. Awesome.
Phil, what's your opinion in terms of, we're talking about obviously tiers, and obviously things like auto tiering comes out and things like that. Do you think you won't need to necessarily think about as much with these things while tiering? Is that something that...
Auto-tiering is a bit of a double-edged sword right now because you have multiple different approaches to it. You have EMCs, you have IBMs, you have compellents, obviously. And depending on who you're using, it might make it easier or it might make it more complicated. Depending on what you're doing with your storage, it could be easier or more complicated. Really, it's something you have to look at very closely before you deploy it to make sure that you get the maximum benefit. If you look at it closely, though, you can see some tremendous benefit from it. The one catch, though, being that if your usage patterns change, you can find that you don't have enough fast disk real easily.
Yeah, that was going to be my comment, is that don't jump into a new feature without enough space to make it worthwhile or enough capacity to make it worthwhile.
So with that, do you think that means just monitor appropriately?
Partly it's monitoring, and partly it's looking at your storage beforehand before you jump into that and saying, do I really need this much performance here? Or could I be just fine by having it down here? The other part of it is like I mentioned, the double-edged sword with multiple different implementations. For example, IBM EasyTier, when introduced, moved everything in 1 gigabyte blocks, so that if you only needed to move 500 megabytes into the fast disk, it'd still take an entire gigabyte block. Mm-hmm. Whereas, for example, Compellence works at, I believe it's the 1 megabyte level, so that if you're working with a database and it wants to move things up, it only does it 1 megabyte at a time.
Well, I can appreciate granularity at the block level, but at the gigabyte level, I've never dealt with a LUN where that distinction would make a difference. So, I mean, yeah. Are we trying to debate the color of ketchup or what? I don't know.
So. That's where it gets into the complexity versus easy. If you've got your thing set up correctly for the automated tiering system that you're using, and this goes to hierarchical management as well, which is starting to become a hot topic again with tape and everything. But if you do it right, it actually solves a lot of your storage housekeeping problems as far as locating your disk appropriately, because your disk just goes where it's supposed to.
Right. So if you can identify, or at least have the visibility, or have the tool that will give you the visibility to see where these things need to go, I guess there's a fundamental thing. You got to trust the management software to do what it's reporting or suggesting to do. You know, a lot of people, myself included, historically have tried to fly by wire and judgment call everything, right? But at the end of the day, we all need the data to make those decisions.
You think a good way to monitor that or help monitor it is use the likes of Storage Array plugins for vCenter and stuff like that. That will certainly help allow you to understand what's going on from the VMware down to the storage level.
I say, if you have the plugin, use it.
Oh, yeah. That brings up another interesting housekeeping point, which is performance monitoring. That really can help you take care of your housekeeping on both the virtual machine and the storage side if you actually know what's going on and where your problems are starting to crop up.
And I'll take that one step further and use these performance tools, be it visual aids or even command line tools. Use those in a non-critical situation first, so that way you know what normal is. Too many times, and again, you get a bizarre error, you dive deep into a rat hole troubleshooting something, but the issue is you don't know what normal is. Okay, so if you have a baseline of some of these characteristics of these tools, it might be a good idea to just get familiar with them, so when the time comes, you have an idea of what's normal. And, you know, everybody might know what's a big workload, what's not a big workload in the environment. So, you know, you might run some command line tool or some, you know, visual aid tool that, you know, gives you performance data. In the normal sense, those two tools are going to give different results. So, you know, get a handle on normal before we can troubleshoot the abnormal. So go ahead, Doug.
I was about to say, yeah, the thing is also is just know what you know, the metrics to look for, things like CPU ready time, you know, latency on a physical disk, things like that, you know, look for memory ballooning, for compression, for swapping. Mm-hmm. Look at these metrics. There's, you know, there's key metrics in there that will tell you if you're hitting contention or if there's an issue with storage or things like that. So, you know, spend some time with vCenter, and if you really need to go into the weeds, then spend some time with ESX Top and understand the metrics and understand what they're telling you.
Sure, sure. And, you know, Phil, how about on the storage side? You know, when you go to look at some troubleshooting stuff, everybody has to understand that the numbers that the SAN or SAN processor, storage processor are going to tell us may be different than what VMware or the OS is going to tell us.
Oh, absolutely. Almost certainly you're going to see differences there because there's a disconnect between your storage and your hosts that consume your storage. So if your host is experiencing contention, it might not necessarily be your storage. It might just be the host.
Gotcha, gotcha. Well, this has been a really good podcast, guys. I think this is kind of a different approach, and hopefully people appreciate it. So we're going to transition to the next segment of our podcast. And Phil, since you were the first, this is your first time on the podcast, you're in the hot seat. I call this segment Three Views from You, and I'm going to ask you some questions based on different points in time. And they're you as a technologist based on any type of experience or your future opinion about technology. So I'll start with the past. So Phil, in your work experience or technology experience in general in the past, what's the best story that you can share with us?
That's a bit of a difficult one. I've been blessed in that I've been lucky enough to generally be on the bleeding edge of technology almost my entire career. I think probably the most interesting one would be back in 1997 and 98. I was working with a company that was working to deploy a voice over IP network, a nationwide one, and got to see a lot of very interesting technology and sort of peer into the future with that. And let me tell you, that view of the future, very different from what we ended up with.
Cool. Excellent. And was it, what was it, the factors in that changed it?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because there were a lot of factors. Back then, the technology was based around routers and switches, and you would use specially built Cisco access servers combined with Cisco routers, and Cisco routers configured as what were called gatekeepers. And somewhere along the way, with the introduction of SIP and other technologies, it's turned into basically Skype, where you sort of have a peer-to-peer network and direct connections without the need for all that additional equipment.
Cool. What about in the current tense or the present? What's most interesting, or what area of technology in general do you have the most passion in right now?
I want to describe it as performance monitoring almost, but I don't want to call it performance monitoring because that's not really what it is. One of my pet peeves over the years has become that a lot of us really don't have a good view into what's going on in our environment. We don't know how much CPU we're using. We don't know whether we're 90% utilized on memory or 10% most of the time. We have to go in and take a look manually, and it just consumes so much time. And I'm really hoping and looking to see the very different approaches that are coming out. We have a couple companies that have announced that they're building more intuitive performance monitoring and application awareness applications.
Mm-hmm. Stack and, the whole stack aware, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and they're trying. One of the other big things has been that traditionally those applications have been horrifyingly complex. You have 32 windows, and you have to set 17 parameters just to get an idea of what the system has looked like over the past 24 hours. And there's been a push toward simplification where, you know, we can now go in and say, okay, well, over the past 24 hours, the system has transferred 50 megabytes of the network. And we can do that quickly and easily.
How about into the future? What's, you know, coming down the pike that you think you're going to have the most interest in longer term?
Well, obviously the easy generic answer is cloud, but I think really what's going to be interesting in the future is how cloud is going to tie into providing service level agreement grade services and how we're going to be monitoring that, whether or not we're able to get adequate response times, whether or not we're seeing you know, increased latency versus local, kind of, you know, seeing how cloud will integrate and perform in production environments.
Gotcha. So pretty much the cloud's here to stay. It's just how's it going to work with everything?
Exactly. And how are we going to, you know, make sure that cloud is doing what we need it to?
Gotcha, gotcha. Well, hey, guys, this has been really good stuff. I really appreciate it. We probably ran over, but this is good stuff. I hope that, you know, this was kind of a different approach for this podcast, trying to just throw out some real, you know, usable data to people, and hopefully everyone enjoyed it. So, again, Phil is on Twitter, at Rootworm, and his blog is rootworm.us.to, straight out of Tonga. And Doug is on Twitter at Douglas_Carson. I'm on Twitter at Rick Vanover, as well as I tweet on behalf of the Veeam account. Doug, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Phil, thanks for being on.
Indeed. Thank you both for having me.